So maybe we'll do an old style intro.
Okay. I don't even remember how to do that.
I do.
Okay, good. I'm going to start us off and you wrap it up then.
Okay.
Welcome to Brain Junk. This is Amy Barton. Nope, still don't. I'm Amy Barton. It's also this is, but nope, this is not going to go well. It will. I've got some fun things to talk about. Welcome to Brain Junk. I'm Amy Barton.
And I'm Trace Kerr. And we're going to go back in time. We're doing a throwback episode of everything you never knew you wanted to know about random facts. Oh, it's going to be good.
How about a little phrase origin? Do you want to know where the phrase turn on a dime came from?
Yes, I do. Of course I do.
Nobody really knows.
Oh, check, done. Your turn.
It's just they turn on a really small thing. It just is, a dime is small and you turn on a small thing.
Oh.
I had a sticky note on my desk for like 3 weeks. I'm like, this is going to be good. It's not.
It's not. That's just it.
Sorry.
We just, that's it. Okay.
Would you like to do another you, or do you want to do some German words?
I've got a short one here. Okay. I've got one that's just as short as the turn on the dime. The first human heart transplant was done in Cape Town, South Africa in, you want to guess a date?
The 70s?
Ooh, pretty close. 1967.
That is earlier than I expected for...
Yeah, me too. I was like, ooh, that sounds scary.
Yeah, that's not computers.
No. Mm-mm.
I like the idea of a lot of computerized things happening during that kind of a... Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now teach me some German.
Okay. I saw the word Morgenmuffel on social media the other day. Like... Those Germans. So a Morgenmuffel is not a morning person. I am a Morgenmuffel until I've had my coffee and then it turns on a dime and I'm awake. So I thought my friend Holly grew up in Germany. And so she was like, oh, the German words, you don't even know. And so I was like, you're right. So here's a few.
Okay.
Fernweh is distance pain, which I really love this. It's like you want, it's not homesickness. It's the opposite. Like you miss the ocean or something.
Oh,
that one's lovely. I think we're all feeling that a little right now, aren't we?
Yes.
Kummerspeck. Have you heard this one before?
That sounds familiar.
Grief. What? Grief bacon.
Oh, yes. We talk about grief bacon at our house. When you're really sad and you just got to fill that hole. Emotional eating. Mm-hmm.
Right. We've all had some kummerspeck, some grief bacon over the past year and a half, 2 years.
Uh-huh.
And we've indulged our inner... Schweinhund.
Schweinhund?
Schweinhund, yeah. It's our inner pig dog.
What is your inner pig dog?
It's your lazy side. It's that little inner voice that says, you don't need to go to the gym. It is fine. So you shouldn't really be listening to your inner Schweinhund. Innerer Schweinhund. But it's definitely been talking a lot lately for me.
Oh, man. It's a lot of no bones days. If you're on TikTok, you know what I mean.
Yes, exactly. How about Fremdschammen? The direct translation is exterior shame. So it's that feeling of cringiness when you watch a show like The Office. I have a high level of Fremdschammen for things like The Office.
I don't like that feeling. That kind of television show or movie or that embarrassment humor. No, it kills me inside.
Yeah.
Can't handle it.
These are all kind of mood things, and they're very things that are pertinent because the next two are Lebensmüde and Weltschmerz. So the first one is that you're life tired. So like the young romantic poets, they get life tired and they're filled with ennui. Mm-hmm. But in German, they're filled with Lebensmüde. And Weltschmerz is world pain. Like you can't even with the world.
Oh,
mm-hmm.
All of these are so wildly appropriate. Why do we not have any of these phrases?
I know. Our linguistic turns of phrase are not nearly as delightful.
No, they're not.
My last one is Zungenbrecher, which is direct translation is tongue breaker. So it's a tongue twister.
Oh,
I enjoy a good Zungenbrecher.
I do too. Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers.
Yeah, I'm not great at them, but I enjoy them.
Oh.
That's my German words. There was a ton more. You guys should just look up great German words because there are so many I skipped that we can't talk for all day on these.
Those were good. Those were really good. Oh, hey, I have kind of an origin story, but it's not It's kind of for a phrase. So September 9th, 1947, there's a team of computer scientists at Harvard University. They found the first official bug in a computer.
Oh, in 1947?
Yeah, yeah. So they were testing a early computer, and there's a lab page you can see, and it's the programmer's journal, 1525 military time. They started a test, and at 1545, the very next time, there is a moth taped to the page. And it says relay number 70 panel F moth. Yep.
Wow.
Next line, first actual case of bug being found. So
literal bug.
A literal bug. Now, we have been using bug in the system for quite some time. Edison used it. I mean, a lot of people talked about when they had a system that wasn't working that there was a bug in it. But this was like an actual moth getting fried inside a computer.
Awesome.
Super great. Yeah. And one of the scientists, computer scientists, who was super tickled by this was Grace Hopper. She was a U.S. Navy admiral and mathematician. So she's like an extra bonus fact here. She paved the way in computer programming and modern data processing. She's responsible for inventing one of the first application-friendly computer languages and the UNIVAC 1, which is the first commercial electronic computer.
Wow. That's a good bonus fact.
So she talked about this... She talked about this bug a lot. And so people think that she was part of that. She was at Yale. This happened at Harvard. But yes, an actual bug. I just love that there's a moth taped to the page.
Me too. I hope that exists somewhere still. They saved it.
They did. They saved the whole page.
That's excellent. You ready for another one?
Yeah. Where are we going next?
Okay. There was once a street called Chuck Norris, but the name was changed for public safety because nobody crosses Chuck Norris and lives.
Okay, now hold on. Are you telling me the truth here?
As far as you know.
You can't be trusted.
Chuck Norris once went to Mars. That's why there are no signs of life.
Oh my God.
And here's a math one. He found the last digit of pi. And contrary to popular belief, Chuck Norris has never cheated death. He always wins fair and square. What else have you got, Trace?
Okay, well, I'm gonna tell you about the history of the bullion cube.
The bullion cube brings great joy to ramen and all kinds of things. Tell us.
Right. In case you, I don't know what rock you've been living under, if you've never encountered like the square, at least in the United States, they're usually cubes, like a piece of, like a dice, you know, that you could roll, wrapped in foil usually, or just bullion in general. Like we have jars with powder. Yeah. So trying to make soup the most eatable of meals, portable. That's what bullion is all about. Way back in the 14th century, Magyar warriors in Hungary, they would boil salted beef until it fell apart, dried it in the sun, and ground it into a powder, and then they would carry it around in little bags to sprinkle into their...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, to sprinkle into their food.
Like jerky soup.
They're like, maybe we need to give it another name. By the 18th century, this fellow by the name of Count Rumford, he was a New Englander. He was trying to invent a solidified stock of bones and meat trimmings to feed the Duke of Bavaria's army. And so he was working on that, but you know, it was a lot of material. So over time, three companies, Maggi, OXO, and Knorr. And I mean, like, have you ever been to a party with adults where they have some sort of artichoke dip? It probably was made with Knorr.
Yes, the veggie dip packet.
Yeah, the veggie dip packets. Well, those three companies were on the cutting edge, there we go, of bullion cubes. So there was boiling down of meats, and they were adding hydrolyzed acid to grains to make amino acids. That's that savory component of soups. And meanwhile, while they were working on that over in Japan, a chemist was isolating the tastiest of tasties, MSG, from kombu, which is like a seaweedy thing, to make that umami flavoring that makes our brains love how something tastes. So it's kind of been this long adventure of, I mean, if there was a war, people were trying to get better at figuring out how to powder something to make it transportable so we could make food out of it.
Yes, I feel like we did a brainstorm about a Civil War chef that had been the Civil War people had been being poisoned by the chefs.
Yes.
Improvements all along the line.
Yeah. And fun fact, during the pandemic, bouillon cube sales jumped by 70%.
Really?
So we were all trapped at home. We're making sourdough bread and lots of soup. Yep.
I can get behind that. That's good.
Yeah, me too.
That's a good one.
Do you have anything else? Can you top soup? I don't think you can.
No, but you couldn't top Chuck Norris, so that's okay. I do have one more good one, and this is a real verifiable one. I'd like to discuss the NHDSC, which is the National Hot Dog Sausage Council.
What?
I've posted on social media about this because it brings joy to my heart. You can be a hot dog ambassador. The application is open now at hot-dog.org.
That sounds like something you wouldn't want to enter into your search browser, but okay.
No, so enter the actual site name. Go to, or look up the National Hot Dog Sausage Council. not Hot Dog Ambassador. But they do indeed have, you have to submit a brief essay about hot dogs, and you have to talk about why you are qualified to be a hot dog ambassador and show your love and devotion. You can include a video or a photo or like a creative element to sway the committee. Oh, and you get a plaque if you win.
Oh.
So that's exciting.
So is it kind of like, is it kind of like Miss America?
I really want it to be, but I think it's more of an honorary position at this point and not a spokesperson.
Okay.
Maybe we should apply and evolve the program.
Yeah, I could be like, hey, I eat super low sodium, so I haven't had a hot dog in at least 15 years, but I would be the perfect person to talk about how amazing they are because they smell really good.
On smell alone, I can advocate for them. Okay, so that leads to some of my hot dog facts.
Oh.
A hot dog without meat or poultry cannot be called a hot dog. So if you find some low sodium meat alternative, it could maybe be called a Frank. I'm not sure what you could call it, but it cannot be a hot dog.
Oh.
It's like champagne.
Got
and,
it.
And hot dogs.
Okay.
They declare that a hot dog is not a sandwich and they do not qualify that in any way.
Okay, personally, I think a hot dog is a taco.
I can get behind that.
Yeah.
Hot dogs were one of the first foods eaten on the moon. That's a fun fact for me.
What?
Mm-hmm.
Was it freeze dried?
Probably. I can see why they would think that's a good idea because it's handheld. You can contain it and elements will not float away. It's not like trying to eat rice on the moon.
Fruit salad was such a bad idea.
I agreed. Oh, and hot dogs can be, they have preservative free ones now, but generally speaking, they're fairly well preserved items.
This is true.
Hot dogs were first sold at baseball games in 1893.
Wow.
The tube steak has been a festive ball game treat for many, many years.
Tube steak.
Mm-hmm. Oh, here's one that amazes me completely. A prime spot for your hot dog stand outside New York's Central Park Zoo costs hot dog vendors nearly $300,000 per year.
What?
Yeah. I can't even imagine how many hot dogs you must sell to make that worth your while.
How?
I know. You don't know.
That's a lot of mustard.
It is, exactly. Yeah. And my final hot dog fact is that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt served hot dogs to King George and Queen Elizabeth, and the king ate too.
You know, I feel kind of bad. Welcome to our country. We have fine food, but what we're going to give you instead is something that you'd get at the fair. I wonder if they had funnel cakes too. That would make me very happy.
So, and American cheese.
Oh, an American
the cheese.
Cheese
course.
Yeah. They're like, what is this strange cheese that, oh, it wasn't wrapped in plastic back then. What is this strange cheese?
Very orange. Yeah. Fruit leather. You don't get a fruit course. You get fruit leather.
Fruit leather.
It's a fully American lunch.
And for our appetizer, you can drop this bouillon cube into your hot water.
Yes. That's a soup course. It's DIY soup.
It's so tasty. But make sure when you stir that you put your pinky up. That's very important.
That's right. Use the correct spoon.
All right. Well, I want to revisit. So we did an episode where you talked about the neurons that critters have and how that determines how smart different things are. But one of the animals that was the outlier, did we talk about the raccoon?
Remind me.
Well, okay, so this is coming to us from the Department of Psychology and Biological Sciences at Vanderbilt University. Usually, the number of neurons that you have in your cerebral cortex corresponds to mass. So the bigger the creature, the more neurons. Primates fall outside of that. You know, human beings, we don't weigh as much as a whale, but we have way more neurons going on.
Yeah, we've talked about this with dogs and cats, I think.
Yes, you did talk about it with dogs and cats, because there was some controversy there of like this one researcher was saying that cats have way more than we think. Well, they've revisited all of that and they were like, OK, here's the deal. Cats, 250 million. Golden retrievers, about 620 million. And raccoons are at 400 million.
Oh, my goodness.
So
they're running for office soon.
They are like up there with the dog, because tiny dogs have like almost as many neurons as cats. But this puts raccoons on the level with like smaller primates. So humans are, just for comparison, at 16 billion neurons in that cortex. But so this was a funny thing. So when asked why the behavioral scientists weren't studying raccoons in the lab for intelligence, because they're like, look, they're super smart, why aren't you studying them? Professor Kelly Lambert said, and I quote, because the lab would have to be a maximal security facility to keep the guys indoors.
Yes, I can't imagine the system that all they have all the time in the world and are very food motivated and they're getting out.
They'd be like making lockpicks and getting out and stealing all the research. Yeah.
The next Jurassic Park is actually about raccoons. Life will find a way. It's a lot funnier.
Super smart for being super tiny. So that completely explains why they're getting into garbage cans and destroying things.
Yeah, so effectively and persistently.
Absolutely.
I'm sorry to say hot dogs was my last one.
Oh, and can I just say that tube steak is hilarious, and my my inner 12-year-old just snorts so much snorting. Yeah. So that is that's a good round of facts. I feel like we've been factified.
We really covered the gamut there.
We kind of did. All
I did
all
not
the
save
world.
Any Chuck Norris's for the end. I really should have. I'm sorry.
It's all right. We'll let it pass this one time.
If you'd like to hear more episodes, ask your smart speaker to play Brain Junk Podcast. You can also check out our Instagram, and our Facebook page is a great place to go if you have comments or questions. Trace and I will catch you next time when we share more of everything you never knew you wanted to know, and I guarantee you will not be bored.